could even sing a little. I tried to find some consolation in the fact that they made me the understudy, but little did I know. On the night of the first run-through, the one night a significant casting director was coming to watch the show, the other Caribbean kid they had cast for the lead, a kid named Harry Belafonte, couldn't make it. I had to go on for him, and son of a gun, the casting director liked what I did and called me. "I'm preparing a version of Lysistrata for Broadway. Would you be available?" he said. Are you kidding? Next thing I knew, I was staring into a sea of white faces from a Broadway stage, scared shitless as I fumbled for my lines as the character Polydorus. The word bad cannot begin to accommodate my wretchedness. I mean, I was bad. The stage fright had me so tightly in its grip that I was giving the wrong cues and jumbling the lines, and within a few moments, the audience was rolling in the aisles, laughing. The moment the curtain came down, it was time for this Caribbean kid to run for cover. My career was over before it had begun, and the void was opening up once again to receive me. I didn't even go to the cast party, which meant that I wasn't around when the first reviews appeared. The critics trashed the show. I mean, they hated it. But they liked me. I was so god-awful, they thought I was good. They said they admired my fresh comedic gift. If you saw this scenario in an old black-and-white movie on TV, would you believe it? I saw it in real life, and I certainly didn't. In my world, effort and reward were expected to settle into a natural balance. By any reasonable measure, I knew that I had fallen short that evening. That was my critical assessment. That assessment, taken at its worth, created a big fat contradiction inside me. Maybe I just wasn't up to this acting thing. Maybe the man at the little theater in Harlem was right. Maybe I should go out and get a job I could handle. I couldn't shake the sense that failure was lurking somewhere in the wings, waiting to pick my bones if my doubts should become reality. Still, in the face of all that, I had to stay in charge of my life no matter how it all played out. Regardless of whatever or whoever else might have been looking out for me, I needed to know first and foremost that I was looking out for myself. Even when the dread of being shot down by failure was twisting my insides into knots. Did I misjudge this new culture? Should all the glitter that now seems only inches beyond my reach have been taken with a grain of salt? Maybe natural balances weren't that easily found amid so much concrete and steel. Amid so many machines, pushing automobiles, lifting elevators, pulling trains. Or maybe at the very bottom, I wasn't yet ready to accept that environment compromises values far more than values do their number on environment. The play ran only 4 days, but to my surprise, my triumph in Lysistrata led immediately to another acting job as an understudy in a roadshow of Anna Lucasta, a job that lasted intermittently for several weeks. Then after a long and lean and frustrating period during which off-Broadway roles happened by just often enough to keep my meager skills alive, I found out quite by accident that 20th Century Fox was casting for a movie called No Way Out, the film that would be the first that Reggie and Evelyn Poitier would ever see. My fingers touched the glitter with that first movie, and it was a mighty reach, I tell you. I knew full well how far I had come from those days in Nassau when I dreamed of being a cowboy in Hollywood. While I was completing that Fox film in L.A., the film's director, Joe Mankiewicz, told me that when I got back to New York, I should look up a producer named Zoltan Korda. I did. entering his office just as he was walking out. "No time to talk now," he said. "Can you come to London?" Next thing I knew, I was on the Pan Am Clipper in a first-class compartment, heading east across the Atlantic, bound for London and eventually South Africa, to play the part of the young priest in Cry the Beloved Country. It was heady stuff, and I couldn't escape the feeling that not only was I one lucky youngster, but something more had to be at play here. I had grown up in a culture where unseen forces lurked just outside of view, where people looked to the mysteries to explain both good and bad fortune. As I tried to absorb the changes in my new life, I butted up against the knowledge that this many accidents and lucky breaks just didn't happen in the movie business or anywhere else. They didn't even happen in the movies themselves. I knew that things could be taken away just as easily as they now seem to come. I rested uneasily on those black and white and scary uncertainties. After returning from London, I at last went back to the Bahamas and came very much back down to earth. I saw my mother and my father for the first time in 8 years. I had gone away a troubled boy of 15, and here I was, a man of 23 that they could hardly recognize. It was a powerful moment when I returned to our little house in Nassau and saw them sitting together, alone, on a Saturday night. It was a moment of miraculous joy, but also a time of wrenching guilt for me, because during those 8 years, I had remained entirely silent. It's an unwritten law in the Bahamas that when people who go to America to live write home, they put a little something in the envelope. I had been unable to contribute to my family for so long that the habit of silence had simply overtaken me, or at least that's how I had justified it to myself. I had to wait until I was in good shape, I had told myself. Still, I knew that Reggie was more of a man than to let 8 years pass without a word. I made amends, but my guilt wasn't canceled. My parents forgave me. They would have forgiven me anything. And I left with them almost all of the $3,000 I had made in my nascent career in the movies. But I knew that, forced to take my measure at that moment, even they would have found me wanting. So, going back to New York was a valuable exercise in humility. After that initial burst of success, a couple of films and a couple of major theatrical productions, I was back in Harlem washing dishes. Perhaps I had a gift from Cat Island buried deep within me, because despite the setback, I still had faith in myself and faith in the future, enough of each to marry a beautiful young girl named Juanita and try to get on with my life. Then a buddy of mine had the bright idea of opening a rib place. We scraped together money enough and opened a little joint, Ribs in the Rough, at 127th Street and 7th Avenue, with seating for all of 13 people. My wife was trying her hand at modeling, though that led by way of necessity to a job as a seamstress at a clothing factory. This life was tough, but we were up for it. Having lived with my mother and father, having watched how they dealt with other people and with each other, I felt prepared for pretty much anything. Soon, our first child was born, little Beverly. And then another was on the way, and I didn't have any money. Our little barbecue place was a hole in the wall. 80 cents for a meal, including side dishes. My partner and I did everything. We cooked the ribs, we made the potato salad, we made the coleslaw, we scrubbed out the place when we closed in the morning. Times were so tough that I used to take milk from the restaurant home for my kids. One day when my wife was pregnant with Pam, I was working in the rib joint. I was tapped out and feeling worried. That day, with nothing encouraging in sight, out of the blue, a big agent named Martin Baum called me and said, "Would you come down? I have something I want to talk to you about." He wasn't my agent, of course. He was just helping out on a casting assignment. His office was on Fifth Avenue between 58th and 57th Streets. He said, "Go over to the Savoy Plaza Hotel, suite such and such. There's a gentleman who wants to see you about a part." I went over. Two guys were there, the producer and the director. We had a very brief talk. They looked me over a bit, and one of them said, "We'd like you to read for us." I said, "Certainly." They gave me a script, asked me to turn to a particular page, and gave me a few moments to look over the scene. When I thought I was ready, I said, "Okay." They had me read the scene with the producer while the director watched. I felt good about the reading, though they didn't say much about it. They asked me things about my life and what I had done in the business, and I told them. They gave me a script to take with me and said they would talk to Martin Baum. They thanked me for coming as I left. I went back and said to Martin Baum, "They gave me a script." He said, "Well, read it. Call me tomorrow, and we'll work out something." I went straight home, 127th Street near Amsterdam Avenue, and I read the script. I didn't like it. The part they wanted me for was a man who was a janitor for a gambling casino in Phoenix City, Alabama. He was a very nice man, but there had been some kind of murder at the casino, and it was thought that this janitor might have some information that could incriminate whoever was responsible. He received threats and warnings to keep his mouth shut, so he didn't do anything, didn't say anything. Then, to augment the threats, the bad guys killed his daughter, threw her body on his lawn. He was enraged, he was tormented, still, he remained passive. He didn't do shit. He left it to other people to fight his battles. So the next day I went back to Martin Baum's office. "What do you think of the script?" he asked. "Well, I have to tell you, I'm not going to play it," I said. Disbelief etched his face. "You're not going to play it?" "No," I said, "I can't play it." "What do you mean you can't play it?" he asked, irritated. "I cannot play it," I repeated. "It's not a derogatory part," he pointed out. "No, it's not. What happened to this guy isn't a racial thing," he said. "Not necessarily," I agreed. "It could happen to any guy in that particular set of circumstances." "So what is it?" he said. "I mean, it's..." He paused, apparently trying to make sense of my response. "They don't call you names, they don't..." He went on to say, "They are not doing this to you, they are not doing that to you." I said, "Yeah, that's all true." "Then what is it?" he urged. "I can't tell you," I said, "but there's something about it I just don't want to go into it." So he said to me, "Well, listen, that's the way it goes, but I still don't understand." I thanked him and left. Then I went over to 57th Street and Broadway, one flight up to a place called Household Finance Company, and I borrowed $75 on the furniture in our apartment because I needed the money. The birth of our second daughter was fairly near, and I knew that Beth Israel Hospital was going to cost me $75, so I had to line up the money. 6 months later, I got a call. "Hello, Sidney Poitier?" "Yes," I answered. "This is Marty Baum." "Oh, yes. How are you, sir?" I said. "Fine. How are you? What are you doing?" he asked. I said, "I'm still in the restaurant business, working." He said, "You haven't had any jobs as an actor?" "No, I haven't," I said. He said, "Come down. I want to talk to you." So I went down to the Baum & Newborn offices across from the Plaza Hotel. They had two or three other agents and three or four secretaries. I went into Marty Baum's private office, and he sat me down. I don't have a job for you," he said. "But I ask you to come down because I want to say something to you." He stared at me in silence for a moment before continuing. "You know, I've never met anybody like you." That part was a pretty good part. It had no racial overtones, and you turned it down. You haven't done anything since, and it would have been, well, it It was paying $750 a week. It would have been a very nice piece of change. He once again asked me to explain why I hadn't taken the part. But all I could say was, "Well, you know, it's the way I am." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know what's going on with you, but anybody as crazy as you, I want to handle him." I said, "Okay." That's how I landed with a big agent, and that's when my career got on solid footing. Now, I couldn't tell him at the time, and maybe it'll sound a little sanctimonious even now after all these years, but I rejected that part because, in my view, the character simply didn't measure up. He didn't fight for what mattered to him most. He didn't behave with dignity. My father, Reggie, was a certain kind of man, and he was a certain kind of dad. He was a poor man for certain. He was a hard-working man for sure. The only thing he knew how to do was tomato farming. But the soil in Nassau wasn't good, and it was a tourist economy, and there was simply no room for him to plant. By this time, he was 50, 55, and he was suffering severely from rheumatoid arthritis, among other things. He had worked in a bicycle shop in Nassau, but after some years, he had lost the job. The only way he could make a living now was to have my brother in Miami send him boxes of very cheap cigars. My father would then spend the day walking around town, going from one bar to another, selling the cigars, one to this customer, two to another. That's how poor he was, but he did what he had to do, and I wasn't going to play any part that might dishonor his values. My mom, too, always measured up. She would go scouring the neighborhood and into the nearby woods, picking up rocks and stones, sometimes as much as 20-pound stones or 30-pound stones, even 50-pound stones. When she had gathered upward of 2,000 pounds into a mound in the yard in front of our house, she would sit under an almond tree with a hammer in her hand and a big, wide straw hat on her head, and from morning to night she would hammer those stones into pebbles and those pebbles into gravel. It would take her weeks to break a pile of stones that reached close to ceiling height in a pyramid fashion. That's a hell of a lot of stones to break. And she didn't work at it for just a few weeks. The weeks would sometimes run into months. When she had an impressive enough pyramid of crushed stones, mind you, other poor women were doing the same thing, a man would come by with his truck and his workers, and he would bargain with her for her pyramid of crushed stones, and he would pay her whatever she was able to negotiate. On average, 10 shillings, 12 shillings, a pound and a half. 15 shillings would have been the equivalent of about $6. The man would pay her the $6 or whatever it was, and his workmen would shovel all the gravel into his truck, and they would go. Then, after some respite of a week or so, she would start gathering stones all over again. But what Reggie and Evelyn did for a living in no way articulated who they were as people. There was this whole race-class thing in the Bahamas, and among blacks, the class thing was prevalent and vigorously administered. If you were really poor, you were without leverage and powerless, and that was the majority of the people. Also, there was a class of blacks who felt they were above you. They mimicked the colonial value system and saw themselves at the top of the black community. It was their hierarchical sort of thing. Well, my dad was so poor that he was dismissed by the black social structure, dismissed by every social structure, dismissed by everyone pretty much, except his friends. He had lots of friends. Now, trust me, the man never complained. These are my complaints, not his. No complaints. He was there. Life was as it was. That's how he looked at it. He knew what kind of a person he was. He knew what kind of a family he had. He knew what kind of a woman he was married to. He had no money. He had to squeeze a living out of the most unusual activities, but everything he undertook was honorable, because that was who he was. And Evelyn, of course, I never heard her complain, never, not once, though she would get a little pissed at me when I grumbled about the kind of clothes I had. I was simply too young to understand our situation. But she may have translated my complaints into an implication of failure on her part or Dad's. In any case, she had answers for that, you know. And the answers were damn good ones. And they had no self-pity in them, and they had no self-incrimination in them. She would say the kind of things that proud and honorable poor mothers have always said. Things like, as long as the clothes you have are clean, they're fine. But when I got to New York and when I got to Hollywood, for whatever reason or by whatever stroke of luck, I was given the tremendous opportunity of doing work that could reflect who I was. And who I was had everything to do with Reggie and Evelyn, and each cigar sold, and each rock broken. That's how I've always looked at it, that my work is who I am. I decided way back at the beginning, back when I was still washing dishes in a barbecue joint in Harlem, that the work I did would never bring dishonor to my father's name. I do what I do for me and for my wife and children, of course. And I do it out of a certain professional ego drive and ambition, like everyone else. But everything I do, I also do for Reggie and for Evelyn. Life in Black and White. My haphazard political education got underway in 1943. The school in which that education occurred was that district north of Central Park known as Harlem, New York. Now, the School of Hard Knocks provided no classes in political science. But long before I arrived, Harlem residents knew full well that politics was a deck stacked against them, an invisible force of exclusion expertly woven into the fabric of everyday life. In the School of Hard Knocks, politics was a name for the way white folks arranged things to their own advantage. Harlem residents had figured a good many things out. One, they knew that for practical economic reasons, there never was a time when downtown politics didn't embrace Harlem as a cheap and handy labor pool. Two, in cultural terms, they knew of downtown politics' insistence on a requisite distance being kept once the day's work was done. Three, they knew that in matters of race, downtown politics had set in place rules and ways to enforce those rules to ensure that all residents from Harlem were respectful of the civilized traditions that had been erected between themselves and the larger community over the preceding 200 years. Four, they also knew that when need required, downtown politics would bombard Harlem with promises Harlem's residents knew from experience would never materialize. The Harlem that I knew for 14 years was an amazing place, a fabled destination, well known in African-American communities throughout the country. Its dazzling power drew visitors of many races from many places to experience, by taste, by smell, by touch, its bewitching energies, its mysterious vibrations, and its signature rhythms, each of which was said to be in the very air a visitor breathed. and all of Harlem's visitors were encouraged to believe that each breath they took would also contain spiritual blessings that came flowing out of the soul of its loving people through the gateways of their hearts. Harlem's attractions beckoned with a wink and a smile. Jazz at Minton's, vaudeville at the Apollo, floor shows at Small's Paradise, comedians and torch singers at the Baby Grand, jitterbuggers at the Savoy and the Renaissance Casino, soul food at Jenny Lou's, elegant late-night dining at Wells, the Palms, Frank's, Sugar Ray Robinson's, the Shalimar, Joe's Barbecue, and after midnight when the legitimate bars closed, the speakeasies would open. There was gambling at the Rhythm Club 24 hours a day. There were pleasure houses offering high-quality interludes at prices that guaranteed satisfaction. And then there was the Teresa Hotel, a symbol of community pride and joy, where visitors of big-time status would hold court, dignitaries from the Caribbean, Africa, South America, and elsewhere. Showbiz heavyweights like the Duke of Ellington, the Count of Basie, Jimmy Lunsford, Louis Jordan, Billy Eckstein, Dinah Washington, Sarah Vaughan, Ruth Brown, and countless others. But the most memorable characters of all appeared suddenly out of another life, and just as suddenly disappeared again. Baron Smith, for example, was a tall, large-framed, brown-skinned man of some 300 or more pounds, who never failed to cut a most imposing figure when he entered or exited the lobby of the Teresa Hotel. Perhaps he would be impeccably done up in a white doeskin double-breasted suit with a boutonniere in his lapel, a Panama hat sitting slightly rakishly forward on his head, two-tone black and white shoes on his feet, and an emerald and diamond ring on his left-hand pinky finger. An ensemble that, taken together, served as perfect background for an elegant, black, custom-made shirt and the Savile Row necktie that completed the picture. Next day, perhaps an off-white linen suit with equally arresting accessories. The following day, an entirely new look yet again. Each summer, this man of substance would return to be eagerly received by the hotel's management and staff, as well as other establishments in Harlem, including certain ladies of the evening who had been graced by his presence and his wallet on previous visits. But Baron Smith's image and presence were a tailor-made fabrication. A performance mounted for a week's run on the stage of Harlem's hotspots, with annual revivals scheduled for as many summers as the traffic would bear. The real life of the real Baron Smith was set in Nassau, Bahamas. There he was a barkeep who sold rum to the locals. His barroom was of modest size, and so were his sales. His profit margin had to ignore other obligations in order to cover his 7-day pilgrimage to Harlem each summer. But dream chases and sacrifices are never strangers for long. My father used to make daily stops at Baron Smith's barroom to sell cigars to the Baron's customers. Life in Nassau was pretty routine and uneventful for Mr. Smith. It didn't boogie. He yearned for a wild-side excitement, but all he could manage was a week of living on the edge, in the ideal manner, in the perfect setting, in the flawless background of his dreams. Harlem, New York. I knew Mr. Smith quite well. When I was about 12 or thereabouts, I used to sneak into the local movie house through a small ventilation window at the rear of the theater behind the screen. The window was too high for me to reach from the outside, so an accomplice was necessary. I would stand on the shoulders of my friend Yorick, and once safely through the window, I would reach back, grab Yorick's wrists, and haul him up and in. We then would slither under a thick curtain hanging over an entranceway that separated the backstage area from the theater itself. Slither on under the first few rows of seats and pop up innocently in the fourth or fifth row. There we would sit doing our best to look like regular paying customers. After roughly a dozen or so successes, one day we popped up, took our seats, and guess what? Standing over us was Mr. Baron Smith. He was the manager of the movie house in those early days. He grabbed us by the back of our collars, lifted us to our feet, and marched us to his office as pictures of reform school flashed through our heads. We knew that if he called the cops, an example would be made of us as warning to all young males of similar age and reckless persuasion. That would mean 6 years in the slammer for each of us. He sat us down in the privacy of his office. "I know your father," he said to me. "What do you think he would say if he knew what you've been doing?" Yorick and I knew that the question wasn't meant to be answered, so we sat quietly. The lecture was short, but it found its mark. "Now get out of here," he said, after letting us stew for a few minutes. "If you try something like this again, you'll regret it for the rest of your lives. What you did is as bad as stealing. You don't want to grow up to be thieves, do you? Thieves wind up in jail. Remember that. Honesty really is the best policy." We weren't going to wind up as thieves. We were already thieves. But we weren't going to compound our problems by being honest enough to divulge that information. Mr. Smith escorted us to the street and let us fly away, free as birds. 60 years have passed since Mr. Smith let Yorick and me walk, but the generosity he displayed was a great lesson for me. Likewise, I learned much from Harlem's generosity in welcoming Baron Smith with his image as a man of importance, wealth, generosity, and presence, all fashioned with clothing and pretense. And its generosity in keeping such dreams alive for Baron Smith and dreamers like him from all over the world. For Baron Smith the dreamer, Harlem was a stage setting reflecting mere images of reality. But the fact is, we, the people of Harlem, were real. Consequently, Harlem nourished another kind of dreamer to speak to our concerns. As a young man, I began to ask myself, who is speaking for me, and who is speaking to me? And as the saying goes, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. From the pages of newspapers, from the radio, from newsreels in the movie houses, and from poems and sermons, teachers, men of vision and courage from all walks of life began to appear. One by one, they spoke to me, and they spoke for me. Paul Robeson, Dr. Ralph Bunch, A. Philip Randolph, Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., Roy Wilkins, Mary McLeod Bethune, Walter White, Whitney Young, Langston Hughes, and others. And in the course of time, the voices of newfound friends from my generation, including William Garfield Greaves, Harry Belafonte, Leon Bibb, Phil and Doris Rose, William Branch, William Marshall, Julian Mayfield, and others, would be added. Like me, they were young. Unlike me, they were not political greenhorns. These intelligent young people, Harry Belafonte, Leon Bibb, and Phil and Doris Rose most especially, would become and remain invaluable contributors to my political education. By their example and my own intense effort at reading the newspapers, I picked up useful bits of basic information every day. In 1945, at 18 years of age and fresh out of the army, I was unaware, for instance, what it meant to be a Democrat, a Republican, a progressive, a socialist, a communist, an anarchist, a northern liberal, a southern conservative, nor had I a clue as to how people who earned those labels differed from each other. It took some time before I came to understand who among the spokespeople for those various positions were genuine allies of those who spoke for the men and women of Harlem and for the youngsters of my generation. But by the age of 21, I had grown familiar with the landscape and had acquired a general understanding of what was driving each major player philosophically. My teachers came in a wide variety of forms and in a great variety of locales. Louise, for instance, lived in Brooklyn, and the trip from the American Negro Theater on 127th Street in Harlem to her doorstep was a long ride. I offered to see her home one night after a late rehearsal at the theater, and I would wind up making that trip time after time. Saintly, volatile, edgy, raucous, bitchy, introspective, sensuous, a talented and daring taker of risks, that was Louise. In acting classes, she was a riveting, hypnotic presence. As a 19-year-old black girl, she was often mistaken for Arabic or Asian or Native American. She was, in fact, a mixed-race person of African-American and white descent, but she claimed only her African-American heritage. Talking with her was a pleasure, mainly because I wasn't so much interested in getting into her pants as I was getting into her mind. She seemed to know a little about everything, and I knew she could help me fill in the blanks in my own general knowledge. Her words touched familiar chords I had often heard inside myself, her voice lodging complaints we both held against the state. Her language, too, inspired me. For instance, the phrase rhetorical bullshit and disingenuous motherfucker. Bullshit and motherfucker I had heard before, of course. But what kind of bullshit gets to be rhetorical? And what need a motherfucker do to be considered a disingenuous motherfucker? Bourgeois Negroes was another. We got locked into a conversation once, I remember, about who she was and who I was as individuals in America. How we see ourselves, how we see each other, she said, should be determined by us and not by people who generally don't like us, people who pass laws certifying us as less than human. Too many of us see each other as they see us, she continued. Time for that shit to stop. We're going to have to decide for ourselves what we are and what we are not, create our own image of ourselves, and nurture it and feed it till it can stand on its own. She looked through the plate glass window of a coffee shop at snow falling on the Brooklyn street near where she lived. I'll tell you one thing, she added. If I have anything to say about it by the time my grandchildren get here, this hypocrisy democracy is going to do some changing. More than a few times, I asked myself if she was just regurgitating stuff she had heard at home from a father who was up on such things, or a mother who was book smart, or some school she had attended, but then I would feel the passion behind her words and know that she spoke from conviction. Things that get sandwiched in between differing opinions, opposite positions, opposing views, these are issues, she explained. All things social, political, religious, financial, personal or impersonal, objective or subjective, over which debates are held, fights are triggered, and wars are fought, these are issues. Louise taught me much, not the least of which was to appreciate how much a greater command of the language can enrich one's life. But our time was short. I soon was off to Broadway, then on the road for several years with the play Anna Lucasta, then off to Hollywood for 3 decades. I lost track of Louise. All my attempts to reconnect proved fruitless. If she survived, and if she had children, It's not far-fetched to imagine them as having been among those young African-Americans of the 60s who sat in at Southern lunch counters, who braved Bull Connor's dogs, who put themselves on the line to end segregation, who worked at taking the hypocrisy out of democracy, as she was so fond of saying. If Louise is still here, she knows that the times have changed. If she is not, then I'm here to witness for us both that the times indeed have changed. When I was comfortable on Cat Island, I was pulled out and placed in Nassau. When I had gotten some comfort in Nassau, which took some adjusting to, I was pulled out and placed in a hostile environment called Florida. Again and again, I found myself having to leave behind the comfort gained and move on. After a time, it became a ritual. For a while, it was New York, and then it was California. It was the various plays and movies and venues of the acting profession. It was the social friends that I would meet and develop at all levels of my life. Most of these friends were eventually left behind. The moving-on lifestyle I had adopted, though not initially by choice, placed all of my friendships in perpetual jeopardy. I became a loner, a separate traveler. I always saw things differently than other people. I heard things differently. I viewed the future differently. Most times I asked of myself much more than I was able to give. I came close to self-destruction on any number of occasions. I unquestionably had to be lucky, since my struggle for survival was no more than a patchwork of trial and error. And I gotta tell you, there was a satisfaction, a pleasure, no, a thrill, in whatever successes happened as a result of dancing close to the flame and beating the odds, in just being lucky. Telling myself I would probably lose took the edge off being afraid to lose. Prepare for the worst. Hope for the best. I did a lot of that. That was the credo that enabled me to get from crisis to crisis. Survival pressed me into being more of a serious fellow than I would have liked, but not to the complete exclusion of some delight and some joy. Only in the Bahamas, however, was delight taken fully, without reservation. A survival tactic that worked well for me was one I had gotten from my mother. "Charm them, son," she said, "into neutral." Being charming bought me time by allowing me to at least temporarily deflect the jabs of a threatening society. You can see within the context of how I lived and how I was beginning to work out a relationship between myself and this complex place that I wasn't free to indulge totally in delights. There were delights, there were indulgences, but I never lost sight of the fact that I had to cover my back, that I was always on stage. Society had created laws to keep me at a distance or out of sight altogether. Learning to survive in that often hostile world was trial and error, step by step, and just as when I was learning to pick fruit from the sapodilla trees, I often got stung. "Oh, so that's how that works," I would realize. So my closet is full of encounters and mistakes and tools and lessons learned truly the hard way. After I got out of the Army and started at the American Negro Theater, I was more of an observer than most. I was from a black culture in the Caribbean, but it was wonderful being a part of the black culture of New York. Life had another rhythm there. Boundaries were emotional and physical, but they didn't confine the spirit. There were so many places where one could find welcome and ease. Delight was plentiful and fully taken by many as far as I could tell from conversations overheard and behavior observed. I was, however, also involved in white society. That's where I went to work. That's where the movie houses were, for the most part. That's where 42nd Street was. I was always going into that world. The lights of Broadway kept drawing me. On a Saturday night, you'd get dressed up and you went downtown, you know. Drawn by the busyness of it, you just walked around and, well, you got addicted to the electricity. There was a multitude of things taken for granted by the city's longtime residents that had to be learned, practiced, rehearsed. Like depositing a nickel and dialing a public payphone. Though at the time I learned that, I didn't know one solitary person in the whole city, much less one who had a telephone. Learning street names and signs. Learning subway and bus routes. Learning where I was welcome and where I was not. Learning to listen harder, look deeper and further beyond that which first meets the eye. Especially since hustlers and pimps sometimes look like doctors and lawyers, no less than doctors and lawyers sometimes operate like hustlers and pimps. The workaday heads of families, blue collars and professionals, downtown and in Harlem, had to become as readable for me as their Bahamian counterparts had in the city of Nassau, only quicker in this American city where time itself seemed to be a currency. The only kind I would have enough of. By the time I had reached my early 20s, I had fought many battles, lost many wars, and lived many lives, unprepared for each of them. Life offered no auditions for the many roles I had to play, and nowhere along the road I traveled can I recall ever hearing the word outsider applied to me. I had for years considered myself an old hand at the game of staying alive. But with failure walking in my shadow every minute, waiting for the misstep that could derail my entire existence, survivor seemed to me a more appropriate label under which my life should be filed. Over time, however, I began to notice the frequency with which outsider was applied to others. The term began to resonate with me, causing me to wonder who I was really at the center of myself. Eventually, I came to see myself in the outsider and the outsider in me. I could see that outsider and survivor often work as partners, but they are not twins. What was it about outsiders, I wondered, that attracted the curiosity of others? What made such personalities tick? What were the forces driving them, forces that kept them intact and in motion, moving to the beat of their own drum, no matter what? Was theirs a way of life rooted in sacrifice and challenge in defense of nobler purposes and higher values? Or was it a lifestyle of out-of-control appetites in a materialistic environment? Were outsiders simply trespassers obliged by the nature of their lives to be constantly on the alert, known as one of those, but never as one of us? For me, as a young man, the most relevant question was, how might such an outsider expect his life to unfold? What were the penalties? What beauties occurred and what scars resulted from all those times when a life-altering situation suddenly jumped in his face, blocked his path, issued a threat, or laid down a challenge, daring him to pass through if he were foolish enough to think he had the stuff to do so? You gotta get by me if survival is what you're after, so suit up, Mr. Outsider. To get where you think you want to go, you have 5 minutes to become a flesh-and-blood person walking in shoes you've never even tried on. But first, you've got to outmaneuver me. Only in my 60s did I fully absorb my outsider status and begin to settle into some kind of comfort with it. I'd been on the fringes for 50-odd years, whether I knew it or not. So at last, I accepted the likelihood that I would always be an outsider. I live in Beverly Hills now, but I'm still an outsider. And Hollywood saw me as such from the day I first arrived. Back at Columbia in the early days, I was doing a picture called All the Young Men. Cast and crew combined were close to 100 people, and I was the only black person on the set. I qualified hands down as the quintessential outsider. Accordingly, I felt very much as if I were representing 15, 18 million people with every move I made. One guy in particular, an electrical grip, took great delight in asking the cinematographer if he wanted to use a tiny spotlight to highlight my eyes. Whenever the cinematographer said yes, the grip would shout across the soundstage for one to be fetched by his subordinates. The N-word was a nickname for that particular spotlight, and this guy used it with relish. Years later, Arthur Ashe made reference in his book to the many times in his professional life when his response to similar situations wasn't his natural response, but rather the calculated response required of someone walking on the edge. Johnny Johnson of Ebony Magazine and Berry Gordy Jr. of Motown have spoken of the same experience. Long-term outsiders know that struggling on the edge can be beneficial in ways more far-reaching than the personal rewards any individual outsider might reap. Ashe, as a black man in a white sport, became an ambassador for this country. When he went to South Africa with the U.S. Tennis Association, he had to be accommodated. He had to be dealt with. Outsiders know that their struggle is being watched. Silently, often dangerously, they bear witness. In the early 50s, I made the rounds of every casting office in New York City. And I would walk through and stick my head in and say, "Hello." And the secretaries and receptionists and even the agents themselves got to know me. It was in 1954 that a guy from the New York office of MGM called and said, "We're doing a film and we're looking for some young actors." I said, "How young?" "Well, you know, it's going to be high school." I said, "Oh, yes, I know some guys." I automatically eliminated myself because I was about 27 years old at the time. I gave them a list of these actors, and they were in touch with them. But they called me back and asked if I would stop in for a test. Well, we did the test, and they sent it to California, and Richard Brooks, the director, was interested. Then they looked at my other pictures, whatever else I had done, and lo and behold, they offered me the part. Now, in New York City, as a black actor in the theater, there weren't but so many things coming my way. As a matter of fact, Broadway had almost nothing for a black man. Over a period of years, there was Lost in the Stars and a play called Deep Are the Roots. Porgy and Bess and a few other musical presentations were in the repertoire. But with all the black actors and actresses and dancers available in New York City trying for careers in the theater, there wasn't enough work to fill a thimble, as my mother used to say. Naturally, there were those of us for whom that didn't sit right in terms of fairness. I mean, in those days, there would be 40-odd plays on Broadway, but none having to do with our culture, our community, our lives. We used to petition the Actors' Equity Association, and we would try to raise the question of more employment opportunities for us. But those of us who petitioned wound up being blacklisted. I was one of the young black actors who became persona non grata, charged with being a troublemaker. The head of the Negro Actors Guild was a man named Lee Whipper, whom I considered to be in cahoots with the very forces that were trying to keep us out of sight and out of involvement and out of participation. One day, On 125th Street at 7th Avenue, I ran into Mr. Whipper as he came out of a little tobacco store on the northwest corner of the intersection. He spotted me, walked right up to me, and started chastising me about my friends, meaning my left-wing friends. Then he got personal. Whipper felt that we blacks should be accommodating and take whatever the system was able to give. This guy was a lot older than I was, so I didn't say anything disrespectful to him. I just listened to what he said. He was blowing off his steam and getting hot under the collar, and then he said, "Look at this, look at this." He opened his coat, and there was a gun stuck in the waistband of his pants. And he said that he would use it on me and all my friends if we fucked with him. But I wasn't a fucker with her, you know, so I just kept my cool and I let him blow. And when he was finished dressing me down and appeared satisfied that he had put me in my place, he walked away. But what he was telling me wasn't new. I mean, as young black actors, we all knew that he was rabidly against the way we saw things. Well, that was the background, mind you, against which I got this particular job offer from MGM. I went out to California to do the movie Blackboard Jungle. I went to the wardrobe fitting, I did all the necessary preliminaries, and I met with the cast. We read the first reading and were scheduled to start work in 4 or 5 days. Then I got a call from the front office from one of the studio lawyers. He said, "Could you come up? I'd like to talk to you for a second." I said, "Sure." I went up to the front office to meet this man, a man I didn't know from Adam, and he said to me, "You know, we've been told that you know some people who are questionable characters." "What people are you talking about?" I asked, though I knew instantly what he meant. Then he came clean and said, "Paul Robeson, Canada Lee." These, of course, were some of the most stand-up people in those days for things racial, and I was proud to be associated with them. I said, "So what is it that you want from me?" He said, "Well, we need you to sign a loyalty oath." And I said, "What am I supposed to do by signing the oath? I must swear what?" It drove me wild that these men could see red but couldn't see black. That was galling enough. But what also appalled me was that I was being accused of being sympathetic towards, respectful of, even admiring of Paul Robeson and Canada Lee, men I did respect tremendously. How could I not admire men of such courage and integrity? Robeson had come to my house and played with my children, which filled me with pride. I got to know him well enough that he became concerned about me, urging me to be careful in my association with him. Well, this studio lawyer, it seemed to me he didn't fully believe in what he was doing. I think he was ashamed of himself because I sensed that he was trying to disassociate himself a little bit from what he was asking of me. I held my ground and said, "Well, I'll have to think about it." He said, "Okay, you think about it. I'll call you tomorrow." I left the office knowing full well that I would be heading back to New York within the week because nothing in the world was more offensive to me than what he was asking. Here I am in a culture that denies me my personhood. I'm taking the Jim Crow car in all trains below the Mason-Dixon line. I live in a city in which I've been rebuffed at the doors of many restaurants, a city where Josephine Baker gets turned away and barred from fashionable nightclubs. I'm living with a constant reminder that the law of this land once declared me to be 3/5 of a human being, and that only 100 years earlier the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court had declared people of my race to be so inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Everywhere I look, everywhere I turn, every attempt I make to articulate myself as otherwise is met with resistance. And here this guy is saying to me, "We want you to swear your loyalty." To what? I wanted to know. Okay. I went back to rehearsal and Richard Brooks asked me what had happened. I said, "Nothing." I said, "The guy's going to call me tomorrow." Brooks didn't say any more, and the next day I went to work, and there had been no phone call. The third day I went to work, rehearsing, getting ready, and still there was no phone call. The day the shooting started, I said to Richard,